I'll be there too on Res Life, so.
Couple housekeeping things. Carol said that it would be less expensive for the city and more efficient for the staff if they were to make the minutes from the recording rather than try to make them as they're watching us. That's all right with me. If nobody objects, I think that's a fine thing to do. Everybody agree? Okay.
Yeah, I'm not opposed to that.
Does anybody have any changes or corrections to the last minutes? All right. Once again, I'm probably going or wish to go faster than most of you want to go. And so let's take that. Your lack of judgment on that subject, the heart, and we'll kind of slow down a little bit. Now, did we decide there's two different points of view on the staff? What?
Sure is a long ways from Battle High School.
We raised your pay. We doubled your pay for serving on the task force while you were...
Go ahead and take a cut.
Oh, yeah. Are we the 21st or the 29th? And I don't care. I thought we were the 21st.
I think it's the 21st.
I have the 21st.
Everybody have the 21st and agree that it should be the 21st?
Chris, can I provide a suggestion for the meeting structure? If we could, I'm just thinking that we'd be best if we had at least three meetings scheduled for each of the tasks or each of the topics at hand.
Okay.
One for the staff to present, you know, a period of time to research, digest, dialogue, and then a third meeting that would be reviewing recommendations.
Formulation of an actual plan.
Correct. Now, we could adjust, but in my mind, it would be easier for me to have those meetings scheduled out. I would see that it would be much easier for the city staff also to have that plan in place so they can prepare documents, get them to us in time, as well as get their presentations in place for each of the tasks.
I think, not that I was wrong, because that means, you know. But I think that's probably a pretty good idea. I think I was... too optimistic in the degree of speed that I thought we could do this. All right, that makes sense. Then we have a presentation, and then an intermediate discussion, and then maybe an adoption of a final, or at least a semi-final report. That makes sense. And if we need more than that, I'm not adverse to spending more, but. If that's our basic modus operandi, subject to change going forth. Okay. That takes us to the discussion of the stormwater presentation and the stormwater utility generally, and whatever recommendations we would like to make. I think we're probably right to break it into the two groups we did, which was the kind of the operations and the money. I think it makes more sense to talk about any recommendations that people have in terms of operations first. Who wants to go? John made some specific recommendations and published them and sent them to us. You want to start?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Let me get my breath here. Okay, so... All right, so what I did is I went back through and studied Aaron's
E's presentation for the last task force meeting, Chris, and then with all those documents on the table, there were a few that seemed to stir my interest, and so I selected those, and I read just the executive summaries of those various studies and reports provided by Aaron, and then the most recent cost of service study, which was done by Burton Associates, dated September 2014, the final report, viewed that, and then also had a, I was on the ballot committee for the stormwater fee increase, and I went back to Aaron, had made another presentation of information regarding the stormwater utility, and I reviewed that, and then had a long time working relationship when I was in private practice with Piper Jaffray. They're a municipal bond underwriter out of Kansas City, and they kind of know what municipalities can do and not do in terms of bond financing and other types of financing that municipalities would get into, Chris. And then also, I've had a working relationship for many years with a bond counsel, who's Gilmore Bell out of Kansas City. And for those that may not know what bond counsel is, that any municipality that would issue revenue bonds on the private market, that those are regulated by many state laws and federal laws, and there has to be an order that the municipality that issues the bonds, that they can stand back and say that we've done this according to state law and federal law. They hire bond counsel to issue a bond opinion that will cite that they have, and that is a valid bond issue according to state statutes and federal law. And they also, pardon?
Technically, bond counsel, although hired by the issuer, has theoretically for their client the ultimate buyer of the bonds. And they're making a representation that these bonds comply with all applicable law and do what they say they're going to do in the opinion. So their ultimate client is not the city nor the person in the home served by the utility, but the buyer of the bond. And he gets a representation from bond counsel that these bonds are fine legally.
Yeah, but the city pays the bill.
That's right. That's right.
But okay, that's correct. And so, and also, it's a, you know, it's like if you worked with somebody for many, many, many years, that they're more than willing to, if you call them and tell them what your situation is and kind of pick their brain, you know, and see what they might think about this and that. And so that's why I called Piper Jaffray, Jack Dillingham, and then Rick McConnell there at Gilmore Bell. And there's a lot on the forefront with stormwater financing, that a little bit in the state of Missouri, we're a little bit strapped as to how you can actually do bond financing. And that what they were seeing is that they were seeing some lease purchase issuances, as well as what they call special obligation bonds that would call upon the net revenues of the stormwater utility. So that's what I got out of there, and then I studied the existing finances. I went back through the stormwater utility's 2015 budget and the 2016 budget. So then I tried to summarize these in a quick fashion. I think sometimes that if there are questions about compliance with ordinances and various matters that we would want to look at that it's in the city processes. Sometimes that can be dealt with during the city audit, that the city has a financial audit done every year, and it's not out of the ordinary that you would request that the auditor check this or that or compliance with an ordinance. And so the scope of services for the auditor would encompass that that provision to review it. And as we imagine that auditors are, that's what they're good at, they can cross-check things, and that's something they commonly do. So if we have something that we see that may not be that we'd want to take a further look at, that we might request that the city do that through the city audit. That's what the first one's about. And that, and mostly with, I think we're concerned about the maybe lost revenue that may be out there, and so we want to minimize.
Let's not go
that.
On to the second one until we, you know, I didn't mean you were going to, but.
Okay. Okay, point number two.
Well, let's stick with point number one a minute.
All right.
Anybody, it's effectively about lost revenue. You agree that that's, yeah. All right.
Could be, yeah.
I think that is a huge thing for all of us. Let me give you my sense of this. The most important slide, I thought, in Aaron's presentation was this one, right? The one that showed the revenue increasing, but the problem increasing faster than the revenue. And the distance was inexorably separating. That is an undeniable reality that I think we all get. My opinion, and I think most of you share this, is that we're not dealing with a financial situation that is soluble by fixing the staff. I think that if you look at the amount of money they have and the way they're using it, the amount of it that's going to actual work, as distinct from, I don't mean that bureaucracy is not actual work, it is, but it's different than being in the sewer pipe, or the stormwater pipe, I mean. The amount of it that's going to actual hands on the pipe is pretty high. And I think everybody kind of shares that view, that we're not spending a lot of money that could be better managed or directed into actually fixing the problem. So a solution to that increasing curve problem, the revenue problem, is not to fix the staff. I don't mean they're perfectly efficient. They're obviously not. Nobody is. But that's not the answer to our problem. So then, Bill has suggested, that fits together with what John's saying, the idea that we should consider some change in the way we bill for stormwater. And there are a number of options there that I've heard anyway. One is bill everybody, all the parcels. Question on that becomes, is that efficient? B, even if it's not efficient, is it? Should we do it because it's fair? And the other one is to change the very nature of the way that we bill. There is, if you think about it, let's assume that my house has the same impervious structure as a McDonald's. The activities that occur in our house and the McDonald's are very different, but our creation to the problem that we're fixing here, or theoretically fixing, has nothing to do with the type of human activity that occurs. It's just a matter of math. This many impervious feet, this much stormwater. Doesn't matter what you're using or how you're using the impervious feet.
Well, I would say it might a little bit as far as car traffic, oil, like more vehicular traffic.
Yeah, I agree.
Be more.
Yeah, like just a big apartment lot complex might be a little more.
Or a car wash is going to be more than a residential.
I might have some specific exceptions. I think you're right about that. But in general, a retail facility versus a home, you're not changing, you're not creating a substantially different amount of the problem. Although I agree with you that there are specific exceptions, car wash being one that I'd never even thought of. Maybe it makes sense to consider whether we should recommend a change in the way we bid so that every owner of real estate in the city pays the same for every foot of impermeable surface. And then do you have some subcategories? I don't know the answer to that question. Is that the issue that we have?
I'm going to add that, there's developers or even homeowners or businesses that are going to install controls in place to reduce water effluent from their property, whether it be detention or reuse or green roofs or whatever it may be. If you have on a per square foot basis, those entities aren't going to be incentivized to reduce the water flow to the watershed. You want them to do that to help burden the load to the watersheds, so you don't want to disincentivize that.
Are you saying then something like, start with the principle that all square feet are billed equally, but if you add to the problem in some more significant way, you might have a change, or if you mitigate the problem in some significant way, you might have a change? I'm not rising to conclusions about that. I'm just trying to articulate the problem.
Consider any kind of credit for any of that. I think this came up in one of the other meetings. We need to make sure that we have a systematic follow-up in place to make sure that they still deserve the credit.
Well, I think the credit you're talking about is maybe just what's required by the city. Or are you talking about like volunteer?
No, I'm talking about volunteer. I think you can see as people drive more towards sustainability, they may go in with a zero discharge. In other words, the concept that they're going to collect and reuse that water on their commercial property and not discharge any more than when they started. Or you may take a parking lot that goes in, which is all impervious surface. Somebody goes in and does some detention or green collection and actually reduces the amount that was running off that property before they developed it.
Well, I think we have more than what was required.
More than what was required by the city ordinance.
And still be evaluating each property on a case-by-case basis.
That's a big problem, isn't it?
Well, if you put the burden on the customer to show that they, or to ask for the credit, I mean, most businesses that offer credits, the burden's not on the business to keep asking you, do you get a credit? You show that you deserve the credit, and then you have a set of 5-year follow-up or whatever they decide to do.
Are you saying you start with the premise of X cents per square foot, and then if the owner of the property, whether residential or commercial, can come in and according to some objective model, convince somebody that I am mitigating, then I get a credit?
It doesn't have to be burdensome, but I think...
No,
it,
I know,
yeah,
but is that what...
Agreed.
I think that's the concept, is if you do beyond the norm and you reduce effluent from your property, you should get a benefit. That's all I'm saying. Because otherwise, you're going to not see... You're only going to see people do that because they think they want to be good guys, good people. But you like to see that there's a benefit by doing so.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are you talking about doing it for residential properties in addition to commercial?
I think if you do an all square foot concept, you have to offer it up to everyone. I mean, the goal would be to reduce runoff and reduce the burden of our system so we don't overtax it and have to expand it.
Who's done it? Who's done it successfully? Does anybody know? Mitigate runoff. Have any municipalities or jurisdictions?
I mean, the city of Columbia has a pretty intensive requirement and regulations that treat that address the quantity and the quality of the water that leave your property, you know, based on how intense and how what the percentage of impervious area you create. And then there's different requirements based on if you're new development, like a green field, versus if you're redevelopment, and there's tiers. So they do have some objective measures in place on how you treat and mitigate stormwater runoff, if you do anything right now.
It's just
but
available.
You could always go above and beyond.
It's just available to non-residential property, isn't it?
What's that?
Just available to non-residential property?
They do have exemptions for R1 and R2 if it's not part of a larger development. Like, new subdivisions are still required to do it. But, like, yeah, if you just did something on your house, you know,
you wouldn't
probably
be
exempt
we,
from having to meet the new stormwater requirements.
We but also
that's what would be above and beyond, I guess, that you would want to try to get credit for.
We also, I think, have to keep in mind that we don't want to shift a lot of administrative burden to the city that actually takes somebody out of the pipe to manage some mitigation program. And I don't know where all those things fit together, but I think it's a factor that we need to consider along with these other ones. My question about who's done it is, I wonder if any other municipalities have done any kind of a fee decrease for mitigation of stormwater.
Right now, the city waives the development charge, I believe, if you provide
in
detention
Columbia.
In Columbia, which, so I guess, majority of new development does not have a stormwater charge right now because you're required to provide detention as part of the regulations. I believe that's how it's written. I don't know if that's how we actually.
Yeah.
But
I asked the question badly. I meant for non-new.
Yeah, I think I know what you're talking about. I'm just adding that as part of.
Yes. I
have a rain barrel.
Yeah, that's
credit for that.
Yeah, is that beyond where we want to go?
Seems tedious, or probably.
It seems pretty small potatoes, doesn't
I knew,
it?
Yeah.
Although important.
I think it'd be pretty tedious to basically assess all the square foot of every residential property. I mean, the data that exists out there, but the manpower to complete
to
it would be enormous. And then to update it, you know, in the frequency it need to be fair.
Yeah,
it makes sense for large commercial properties that have a lot of impervious surface to do that, but for residential, it's a lot.
You building permits. You get updated through building permits. When a person applies for building permits, they'd update their impervious area.
I think it would be better to keep the utility rates for residential properties lower than commercial, which is, from what I understood from reading, is already the case, and do more public outreach about how you can make your home more sustainable, like putting in rain barrels and things like that, and how it actually affects how the city operates.
Okay, why would it be better, or why is it better, to bill residential property at a rate different than commercial?
Because not all owners of residential properties can handle the cost burden of increased rates. And, you know, I don't know about everybody else in the room, but when I look at my bill that comes from the city, I'm not looking at, okay, stormwater cost me this much and sewer cost me this much and all those things. I look at it as one big bill. And when I see from year to year that it increases by X amount and I'm going, we've put in all these practices to reduce our electricity and water consumption, why are my bills still going up? You know, I may personally be able to handle an increase in the stormwater rate, but I'm just thinking there are other people in the city who probably can't.
So it's a social or political consideration rather than an economic consideration. There's no physical reason why you should bill homeowners different than. I'm not saying that those aren't good reasons. I'm saying they're in a different category of reason.
I did like the point Cody made, though, about I never thought about the dirty runoff versus regular regular runoff.
Oh, and I guess typically commercial is more intense, like you're at a higher percentage, so you have more runoff per acre of development versus in residential, you don't have as much impervious area on, you know, larger sites, so you're
talking about like the percentage, like your home, you probably have a big yard, whereas a commercial property probably doesn't have any.
If you just have your roof drains discharge under your yard, whereas in a lot of commercial, you just downpipe or storm inlet straight to the system. So there's no discontinuous, you know, where you get some infiltration through soil. It's just more intense. I'm just pointing out. Yeah. I would tend to, like, I haven't thought about it until you brought it up, but I would tend to think that commercial would be, you would want to charge a higher premium.
Because it tends to be more intense.
Intense, and you typically, it's more vehicular traffic, more likelihood of
nastiness.
Yeah, litter, all that kind of stuff is going to be higher in commercial areas.
A nasty fee.
Yeah, I got it. Maybe.
I would suspect, just look at that chart, and you see the growth chart, that there's such a backlog as identified in the presentation of projects that need to be done, that even if we were able to improve the collection by 10%, would that be enough to cover the backlog of projects? I mean, we're dealing with the history of a system that has grown rapidly and has still a lot of old infrastructure that needs significant investment. So it seems to me it needs short-term capital to get things caught up to a point where the rate can establish and keep the utility from expanding their deferred maintenance list.
That goes, in my opinion, to John's point about bonds. I think that's absolutely correct. We are dealing, one of the reasons we're getting a bigger spread, isn't it, is because our base infrastructure in many cases is very old and dilapidated.
Yeah, and the stormwater utility wasn't created until 1993.
Mm-hmm. And we started creating the problem in what, 1900 or
yeah, plus or minus. Yeah.
Well, and noting that, like, I scanned through the Black and Veatch from 1983, and they recommended the rates be 195, I believe. And I mean, right now the rates aren't that high, even. So, you know, in today's, and I just out of curiosity looked at it in today's dollars, and it was like 470. You know, so we've got a lot of catching up to do.
Another question that I have is, without rising to a conclusion of whether it's a good idea or not, if we were to change the billing system to all property being equal, the answer to my question is, it matters where you put the number. I'm thinking, does it raise any revenue? But that means you got to raise it on exactly the people who have to approve it.
Well, that's why in the first bullet there, in the last sentence there, that as we go through all kinds of policy changes, we probably ought to make sure it lands on the revenue neutral side so that you're not wouldn't give the appearance that did all these changes to get another $1 million in revenue, that, you know, if we're going to balance it out, then some will pay more and some will pay less or whatever, and that it's end of the day it's revenue neutral, but we have a better system.
Staff guys, I really would like an answer to the question of Two questions. One, has anybody done any mitigation billing current? I don't mean new stuff. I mean billing mitigation to billing decreases as a reward for mitigation. And how much revenue would we generate if we were to bill those people that were not billing today? And what do we think, that there's 6,100 parcels not being billed, something like that? Isn't that what the...
Yeah, but that was in 2011 or something.
Okay, close.
Yeah.
Ballpark, 6,100. The question becomes, so what? If we were to bill those, what does it get us? Versus how much trouble is it?
Gets you an appearance of fairness.
I agree with that 100%. And the question is, is it going to be a net positive or a net negative and financially? And if it's a net negative, then you have to think about how much you're paying for your fairness.
What would be the downside of billing people that should have been getting bills all along?
Why aren't they getting billed?
I don't know. Why aren't they getting billed? What's the answer, somebody, John?
System we have bills to a, it's like a renter, okay? They don't bill to the property. We do have a landlord reversion act, but you have to sign up for it to do that. So some property owners do that. Some property owners don't do that. And so we'd be sending it to an empty mailbox, number one. And so for 65 cents at the time or whatever, it wasn't worth billing, it, as the finance director tells me. The other thing is a lot of people, you know, you can't force them to pay it, number one. We have a lot of outstanding debt for that. And so we are trying to solve that. We're looking at a new financial system that can bill the property owner. There's one address in there, and it's to the renter, and that's where all of it gets sent. To make it go to the property owner, you'd have to be back and forth, but you have to sign up for that. So
I don't know the reason for this, but or if it's a good idea, why are we billing renters at all?
That's the good question. That's the way it was set up.
Bill all real property owners rather than renters.
I would love to do that, Mr. Kelly, but it takes an act, and it's not very popular, I'll just say, with a lot of the
landlords.
Rental, yes?
Landlords.
Landlords, that's the word I was looking for. Some wouldn't bother, some, you know, they come out of the woodwork on it, and it's just like taking care of your sidewalks or your sewer lateral, you know, at point of sale. They don't want to do it, you know, and so the council takes a lot of heat for even talking about things like that. So.
Is my question better, what would be the difference in revenue if we were to bill all property owners as distinct from the way we do it today?
Revenue would go up.
Would it go up enough to make a difference?
It would be more equitable, yes.
But I agree, it would be more equitable.
I don't know about how much difference because of the cost is so, you know, the bill is so low at this point. As you increase the bill over the next 5 years, yes, it will make a difference. Today, probably not.
Yeah, and the other question is, if I make a living selling wings across the street or wherever, why should I pay my stormwater differently than if I make a living renting apartments with my real property?
So you're talking about the fairness. Why don't we do the same?
Yeah.
I would go to what Cody was talking about. I believe it was set up to be based on water quality as well. If you have houses that disconnected that have yards, much like sure. Ms. Bull said, that water's cleaner running off your property. If you're talking about a commercial site such as a Walmart, it's much faster. It gets off of there quicker. What we call time of concentration is quicker, which causes erosion and those kind of things. So that was, I believe, was taken into account in setting up the structure the way it was back in 93.
Sure, because you got to build the system to accommodate peak.
Yes.
Flow. And they're contributing a lot more to peak flow than is an equivalent square feet of homeowners.
Correct. Correct.
I guess the counter argument, just countering what I said earlier, but I guess the residential, you do have the sprawl of more linear feet of pipe, you know, going out in the residential sure. subdivisions, and it's smaller, and but you'd still line you have to maintain as opposed to condensed, but larger.
The impact to the stream is greater off the commercial than it ever will be off the house.
A couple of possible solutions to the problem of billing. You could bill, like if you had a 100-unit apartment complex and five units were vacant, you'd send one bill for those 5 units of vacancy to the owner rather than 5 bills to the owner.
You know, I'd rather do it all to the owner bill.
I mean, yeah, but...
Because if you do 5 units, which 5 units, and, you know, it gets into which ones are vacant. You can always have 5 vacant, you know.
Well, and you don't have to deal with all the turnover, right. Follow-up and all that.
So it's easier to do it one direction and then have to split it up every month. It's a lot of work, I'll tell you.
Are apartments really the only issue here? Because, I mean, most of the commercial property is already established with the rate, residential established with a really relatively fair rate. It's really the apartments. A multi-dwelling, high-density apartment that really, I think most of the people agree here, that probably should be paid on square footage of impervious surface by the owner, not by each renter.
I believe it should be by the owner, yes.
So that's it's not like it's a global that. Change other than just one category that doesn't seem like it's being treated like all the rest.
Because the homeowner is paying that for the most part.
Let me try to formulate a question. What would be the financial, and fix my question, if anybody wants to, what would be the financial and operational impact of changing from billing renters to billing owners? That's number one.
I would have to find out.
I know. And the second one is apartments are now billed as residential, right?
They have
different
class per unit. So,
what would be the impact of changing rental units, or maybe multifamily, multi-resident rental units, to the commercial rate?
Are you saying that the tenants are residential bills? If I rent the apartment and I've got the utilities, I'm a resident. I get the residential rate. But if we shift the stormwater,
it's per unit portion. Though. It's not a first floor area. It's a per unit cost.
Okay. So if we shifted the stormwater utility portion to the apartment owner, that's what you're talking about, carving out that piece. The tenants would still have to be responsible for their own utilities, water and light. But then the apartment owner would be paying the stormwater portion.
Yes.
That's I think what we're.
And the city be responsible for.
Question I'd have in a high-rise apartment, you get a tier rate, you get a residential rate that's a fixed number per month. If you have all those, say 100 units on a small square foot basis, wouldn't that cost per that impervious service actually be less?
Yeah.
Went to commercial, yes.
Yeah, probably, if you went to the commercial rate.
Is it square foot of building? We would lose money. So it's in square foot and impervious.
In
it
some
probably
cases,
would go down.
In some cases it might go up. Most cases on these high-rise, high developments, it's probably going to go down.
It might. It's interesting, isn't it, that the high-rise apartment would put more burden on the sewer and less burden on stormwater.
Correct.
Don't these play, I mean, we were talking about them not choosing not to pay then, and then what do you do? But aren't they having to pay fees to the city annually anyway for business licenses or occupancy licenses and property taxes? I mean, don't we have all of that anyway in another part of the city billing system? And then I do what I'm supposed to do because I don't want to get in trouble, but I don't know if I actually would get in trouble. Surely somebody would come after me at some point and make me pay something I was supposed to pay.
What? Joe, sophomore, transfers to LSU. And he goes away owing $9.85. I mean, what are we going to do? Nothing. Mm-hmm. And we shouldn't do anything because it's worth it's cost more than it.
After a certain dollar amount, doesn't don't most of the debts go on your credit report over a certain dollar?
Yeah,
but depending on the type of debt.
But it's probably a diminishing returns curve, isn't it? If you think about it, I mean,
probably enough for most people,
especially in Columbia. Chasing Joe sophomore to Baton Rouge is,
or for most folks, isn't them knowing that. Not just, you know, going, well, you don't really have to pay because we're not going to do anything anyway, is probably not the way best way to approach it. You know what I mean?
No, but if you change it to the landlord, then he's putting it in the rent and he can collect.
Well, right.
But in a large commercial development, I'm talking about high-rise development, like we've seen to come in downtown area, they're taking impervious surface, building another impervious surface with about the same amount of square footage to the sky. Now, what they're adding to is sanitary sewer, but since they add detention and controls in place per the city ordinance, the actual water leaving that property goes down when that's developed. But yet, I think they still pay the same amount per square foot or per dwelling into the system.
Isn't that okay? Doesn't that end up being okay? I mean, if they're not contributing to the problem, they're not contributing
really
to the problem.
Is when people are taking green space and developing that, that's really creates more burden.
That's right. No question that density is good for infrastructure.
Now we're back to square one. We just need to raise our rates for everybody.
Yeah, we can't do that for a long time. Just did it.
Well, it took us 20 years, so we probably ought to get started, right?
Well,
keep our momentum.
What other questions do we want the staff to answer with regard? I hear us kind of fishing around in the pool of making the billing system more equitable and more productive and more efficient.
If you went to billing the property owner, could you go to quarterly billing?
Go to quarterly billing?
Yes. Make it more economical to bill a property owner with one unit.
What do you guys think about that?
I like that idea because it does save money. It's you know, you're not billing for pennies, you're billing for actual dollars, and it would be more effective. And actually, Tad and I talked about that with billing moving under utilities. We're looking for those kind of responses. We've discussed trying to put it on the property tax even bill, but the legal says we can't do that.
Schawacker won't do it, will he? Schawacker won't do it.
Yeah, well, it can't be a property tax. Can't be on the property tax bill. So,
accept any online payments for any city services?
Pardon?
Do we accept any online payments for city services?
I believe so.
Do we get a credit for doing that, I wonder, saving on postage?
You used to charge extra.
They charge it extra at one time.
Well, the school does, I think.
So, but
too, yeah.
But I think quarterly is a good thing to look at.
I think for residentials, the people that are living paycheck to paycheck, quarterly is probably not a good idea because they want to just take a little bit every month. But definitely the commercial entities ought to be paying quarterly or at least annually.
The big apartments as well.
Right.
But we don't like quarterly for residential, you think?
I think you'd give them the option. I mean, it's
oh, sure,
them.
That's a good idea.
You know, give them the option because you know.
Is it a good idea?
Could you get the option to get it with your utility bill?
Pardon?
Could you get the option of getting your charge with your utility bill?
So you could either see it the way it is now with your monthly bill, or
you could have the option, I would think, with our new system, how you'd set that up.
If an owner lived in the apartment, the house, he could get it either way.
Yeah.
What happens if I don't pay my utility bill?
Well, at one time, we'll go at collection-wise. I mean, we're shutting up. If you don't pay the sewer, we can shut the water off. Hmm. I'm assuming if you don't pay the electric, you can turn the electric off. That's how we handle, you know, in the water, you can shut off. Stormwater is just, you know, we'd have to go collection-wise through the courts.
We can't make it a lien.
I'm not saying you can. It's tough to do on that small a bill a lot of times.
Yeah.
File a lien. And
Right, it's not worth it. I agree.
Yeah. And you indicated earlier you're in looking into aggregating utility bills to a single owner, like they own multiple properties. A single owner, or you?
We've done that with a few, but I don't think we've done that holistically. I know we do with the university. We aggregate some of their stuff.
Can you shut the water off if they don't pay their stormwater bill?
The university?
No, the world in general.
No, there's no law for that. The law is for water and sewer. If you don't pay your sewer, you can cut the water.
By law, you mean council?
Statute.
State statute. Who the hell writes those?
That's another meeting.
Okay.
So for my own clarification, means me and my family, like, we own multiple rental properties and the gamut from however many dwellings per site. But so is what we're talking about where we, as the landlords, would receive potentially a quarterly bill for stormwater only, and then obviously the other rest of the utilities are still billed to the tenant themselves? Am I understanding that right? Because then are we just sending twice as many bills out?
I don't know if we reached that question yet. Because maybe the answer to the question comes with when we talk about sewers and electricity. And maybe that's an example of fitting these together near the end.
Yeah. I mean, with accounting in the city, are they going to send out twice as many bills and create all that more paper and work?
It's the right question. I don't know the answer.
I think it should be evaluated from both ways because it could be a negative. In other words, you could run this analysis and go this per owner and then realize because of the high dwelling, the multi-apartments, suddenly you've lost revenue and we've gone backwards. So you may capture the fairness, the occupancy issues, but then, in essence, they end up getting less money.
They're
drawing into the utility every month, and that's not a good thing where they are right now.
How would we figure that one out?
In some parts of the city, that may be the only bill you get. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's Boone Electric, and County Water. You may only have a sewer or a stormwater, which there wouldn't be a meter charge. And so, you know, that's where we run into a lot of problems is when there's not a metered service that the city owns and we're doing non-metered service, that's when people quit paying their bills because there's no way to cut it off.
I got you.
Sure.
Well, I don't know that we have the problem in Columbia right now, but it's not to say we wouldn't or haven't, but if you have rentals sitting empty, you're not getting stormwater. You're not collecting stormwater rates for as long as that's not occupied.
That's right.
And then it goes back to some of the commercial properties or parking lots and other sort of abandoned-looking areas that I've always wondered, who's paying for that? You know, they're not getting utilities. There's still a ginormous slab of concrete out there. No one's paying for this runoff on that. And we're just letting that go?
Some of it. As of right now, we are.
There.
I think there's a provision for it to revert to the property owner if there is no tenant. Whether or not it happens all the time.
I think we clearly don't want to get in a situation where we're sending some bills quarterly and some bills monthly because it's a pain in the neck for the recipient and it's more paper and it's more paper for them.
I mean, from an administrator standpoint.
Yeah, on all sides, it's a bad idea.
Yeah.
So we should be consistent. If we're going to go quarterly, we got to go quarterly. If we're going to go monthly, we should go monthly. That's how it strikes me anyway. Okay, what other questions in this area do we want staff to answer? You guys are hearing these things, aren't you, these questions?
So currently, the way apartment dwellings are billed is if I understand correctly, is to the resident, and they're within that tier one, tier two, tier three, four structure. Is that correct? Okay. Okay. Do they pay the, when the landlord pays it, are they paying the same amount that would get paid if the residents were?
Yes, they pay the same amount. They pay 65 cents per unit.
Okay.
And there are a few, not very many, but a few in town where the landlord has chosen to pay that fee and not have his residents have that as part of their utility bill.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that.
David, you could have a single family residence was rented?
Excuse me?
You said only one tier one, tier two. You could have a tier three or tier four as rental property.
Well, we were talking about apartments, I thought, and that to me means multifamily, and they're only tier one or two, tier two. But yes, you could have single family homes that would be rented out, and they would be a tier three or four.
Single family home that's rented now billed to the renter. Is that correct?
Correct.
Could that be treated differently than it's treated if we were to change and bill the owner for a multifamily? I'm wondering if the single family residence should be in the category of the homeowner or in the category of the rental property. And I don't know the answer.
Is that going to generate revenue one way or the other?
Yeah, and I think it's relevant both things. Does it generate revenue, and is it fair?
You want to be consistent.
If you want to be consistent, what?
You bill it to the owner.
Well, do you? Maybe the difference, and I don't know the answer, maybe the difference is whether it's a single-family dwelling or a multifamily dwelling. Maybe you're being consistent to bill all single-family residences in one way and all multifamily residences in another.
I think the single families would not have utilities on. I mean, there's probably a rare case where someone turns them off completely. But someone's paying those utilities, whether it be the landlord, the owner of the home, or the renter. Someone's paying that bill.
Real estate company.
I mean, it's a real estate. Could be a bank.
You rent houses, right? What do you think?
I don't. I mean, from a landlord standpoint, I mean, honestly, I don't care about 65 cents.
No, but I know you don't. But what do you think? You have a more hands-on.
Yeah, that's what that first or last question or what I addressed the last time. If it's something coming, you know, I don't want to get a bill for, I don't want to get 100 envelopes in the mail for 100 different properties and pay 65 cents and then put a 35 cent stamp on it. You know what I mean? It would be completely impractical.
Do you pay an annual fee, licensing fee for rental to have? Yeah. I mean, could you not? I mean, is that consolidated?
Yes.
I mean, you're not billed 100 bills for that, right?
Right?
So, I mean, could you? Wouldn't in the during the process? Couldn't those be consolidated?
I think they should be.
Yeah.
Billing. I think we're kind of getting off track, but yeah. I mean, there's money to be saved there too. But I don't know. That was the whole question that I was raising. Let's not just keep sending out. Let's not create more paper and not bring any more money
in.
That's
why I asked you. Now, what happens if one of your places is vacant?
Hopefully it's not for long.
No, I know. But
because we have enough properties where we do the reversion or whatever that Glasscock was talking about, where if somebody's not paying their bill, it flips back over because it's going to take us more time and energy to call down to the city and get somebody back out there to turn the power back on and everything. Where And then, I mean, we personally just take that upon ourselves where if Tommy and Susie aren't paying their bills, then we're going to take it out of their deposit or whatever. If it does go back and if it is reverted back to us because of non-payment on their behalf. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so.
But that's
what
more
I hear
of an
you
internal
saying is
thing.
If renter is not paying them, you, the landlord, end up paying them, but doesn't that's not true of all landlords.
Single. Well, like Glasscock was talking, the reversion, some landlords have that set up on their properties and others don't. We do it because I'd rather pay a $2 fee as opposed to spend 15 minutes for every property, turn it back on or calling with the city and getting somebody else out there. It's just more, makes more sense for me as a landlord to do that.
I've got to feel like you're the exception to the landlords in general, though. I mean, especially in the single family. My son's selling Boy Scout popcorn, so we've been pounding the pavement hard. And there are a shocking number of houses from neighbors talking, don't go to that one, it's been vacant for a year. Don't go to that one, the owner's died, it's been vacant. The kids haven't decided. You know, I was just, it might be small potatoes, but I'm just saying that there are a lot of properties that just sit, and if you're not billing somebody, I don't know, or if they're rentals, you're not billing the property owner.
I guess I understand. I'm just a big fan of not having vacant apartments or houses.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. I got a question in regards. We go back to the budget. You're bringing in, if I'm not mistaken, somewhere between 1.2, 1.4 million a year in storm sewer fees.
Yeah, about 1.2 right now with the rating increase that was approved.
Just guessing, let's assume 10% aren't paying their bills or a portion of 10%. Even if you collected all 10%, you're only looking at another $100,000, $150,000 a year. We're looking at a multi-million dollar problem in the future for this utility. I don't see where this $100,000 that we're talking about in making fairness a collection is going to make much difference or a dent into the problem. I think it's really more of a capital issue. And is the rate appropriate, and are they drawn? Do they have enough to catch up? In my mind, I just look at those charts that you shared earlier, Chris, and we saw them in the presentation. There's a huge capital need for the future. Is the rate going to be there enough to capture the needs, what
to
needs to be done?
Next. I wanted to go there to the capital.
If we develop a better system, we get more money. If we develop a better billing system, it's to our benefit.
Sure.
Even if it's $110 a year.
Okay.
I agree, like I said, but I don't know if it's enough to cover the deficiency that's needed in the future. It's not all the solution. It might be a piece of it.
Yes.
Let's not go into the capital yet. Let's finish with this. I think we're getting near the end of asking our questions about ways to make the billing system more efficient, more fair, and more productive. Does anybody else have any other questions in that narrow area or any other comments in that narrow area?
I'm just wondering if the city implemented the stormwater rate study, the draft report from that's September of last year. The changes there would answer the question we were asking about whether it would be more financially feasible to bill a property owner of a multi-unit or individual properties, and I think the answer would be no. That was implemented. Even if it wasn't, quite frankly.
It would not be more efficient?
Uh-uh. Prior to this. So the analysis page on page 5 of this report says that for an impervious area for residential multifamily of 25 units, the current rate those units would be paying is 65 cents, and so the total bill would be $16.25, but with the change it would go down to $11.67. So fairly comparable, but not exactly. Office building at 22,000 impervious area, so close, had a rate of 4 cents that was changing to 5 cents, and so their current bill was $915. So that would kind of give us the idea of if you were paying for the whole building, it would actually be less revenue than paying for individual units. Sorry, that was muddy, but that's basically what I came at from that.
So financially, it sounds like, correct me if I'm wrong about this, financially, does it make, if that's all you're thinking about, does it make the most sense to have the landlord pay the 65 cents or whatever per unit for multifamily dwellings?
More like if the landlord was paying the commercial rate as opposed to
more than,
the
residential. It's more than if they were paying the commercial rate.
If they were paying the residential rate, it would be more than
but they the were paying rather than the tenants paying. Then you'd have a greater efficiency.
No matter who's paying at the residential rate, it's going to be higher than if you're paying at the commercial rate.
Yes, and you you'd collect it more efficiently, completely, if you were billing the landlord directly rather than the tenants, and it'd be cheaper.
You can't bill a tenant when the utilities are off.
Right. Well, that's what Chris is getting at, is that if you wouldn't be billing the tenant, you'd be billing the landlord.
Correct.
You'd also add additional impervious surfaces not captured right now, which would be parking lots and drives on the large commercial rental property versus, you know, residents.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because you do total impervious surface calculation on those big commercial properties.
Any other thoughts or questions on the billing form and amount question area? All right, let's move to capital. I think it was just articulated a minute ago. We have today a significant, it's the gap, significant capital gap that will take X dollars to get reasonably caught up. What is X?
Depends on how many years, I think.
About.
We're talking about 1 to 3 or 3 to 5.
Well, that's in here somewhere.
3 million to 8 million?
It would be total or net present value. That should be net present value, that because you can't do all the work all at once.
Something between, am I correct to start with it somewhere between $3 and $8 million?
I think it's about 15 million over 10 years.
15 over 10 years.
What we figured out pretty close.
Of your 10-year projects, it would be about 15
after years. After this next 5-year projects that we've pretty much got lined out in the CIP with the proposed rate increases that the voters approved, following that, we're about 15 million short over the next 10.
Do you know what the analyzed value is, assuming typical inflation? Anybody calculated that?
I've got them doing that.
It's a
calculation that you asked for last week about the different bond sales and rates and all that, but I don't have the information back at this time.
Okay, one question. Go ahead.
I was going to say, over the next 5 years, what was our revenue versus what we thought we needed? What was it like? With the rate increases, we're going to be at $3 million?
At the end of 5 years, our revenue would be around 3.3 million, I believe.
I think the study said we needed 8. Is that right?
That, yes, but that's.
Or the just this?
That's more than just the CIP projects that we have identified now.
Oh, okay.
My next question is, what would it cost at today's rates? And I don't expect you to have the answer this minute. What would it cost at today's rates to bond, say, 5, 8, and $10 million?
We're using our cost of service study model to do some different scenarios on bond sales, and then what would the rates have to be to pay those bonds back to try to close that gap.
And the argument would be, we got to close the gap. We got this gap, I mean. Mm-hmm. If we close this gap, then our current rates would be reasonably could be reasonably expected to handle the operational problem going forth. Am I right about that?
Except for inflation.
Yeah, I mean reasonably, we'd be in the bulk. We can come back in 6 or 8 or 10 years or whatever.
Yeah, I think that's, yeah, probably right. But like I said, they're doing that analysis, and I should have that fairly soon.
Okay. Is that the right question that we want to know?
I have a question on the $15 million. I know you covered very briefly in the presentation of all the capital projects that you have. How many of those would you rank as top, whether you got a failing system or pending failure? In other words, the have-tos. I always kind of categorize this. There's the stuff you have to do, the stuff you want to do, and the stuff that you never do. But what's the most
important? Of that 15, I would say that probably just about all of them are the have-tos.
Okay.
There may be a couple studies in there that wouldn't have to be done, but probably should be done.
Okay.
Let's see, does it do any good, David, to, if you would equate that to $10 million, then we could use it in, extrapolate it
sure.
to whatever, to $15 million or to $5 million or to $20
million? Is that- mm-hmm. I think that's right.
Yeah.
Want it? You'd rather see it in 10 million value?
If you looked at it at 10, you could either have it or double it or multiply it by 1.5 or whatever, you know. That's your point, isn't it?
Correct. Yeah.
What term is the city bonding projects on right now? 30 years, 20 years, or is it variable? Yeah. What's the term of bonding that the city's doing on capital projects?
That's the only, or does anybody else have any kind of rational approach to the gap, the big gap problems in the system?
Well, I think a little bit of the notion goes into what I was addressing in, I guess, item four there. There's no statutory authority for stormwater revenue bonds.
The city could issue the bonds for stormwater. The city, the utility wouldn't be the issuer. The city would be the issuer.
Yeah, but there has to be a statutory authority to issue those bonds. There's statutory authority to issue electric bonds, water bonds.
You could do GO bonds.
Sewer bonds. Now, the GO bonds, you could do the GO bonds, which is an ad valorem tax, but you can pay GO bonds off from system revenues. But, you know, You go for voter approval of a GO bond, and you're going to be a very delicate cause to convince somebody that you're not going to raise the taxes.
I agree.
That might be a hard sell.
I agree 100%. That's the answer. Whether we do it or not, or if we do it, in what form do we do it, is a different question than what it would cost.
Yeah, and then, Chris, on the municipal finance people and the bond council, there's a lot of interest in Missouri, those ones that have formed the stormwater utility, to try to get some revenue bond authority placed on the books to
do
that.
I think that's a reasonable thing. I think the municipal league would be inclined to be supportive.
You know, the lease purchase thing is that's kind of a – it can be done. The figuring out the security that you have to give for the lease is could be a little tricky.
How do I repossess a sewer?
No, but you're
right.
But it's based on the repayment ability, and you know the chances for it to go in defunct are pretty small, you know, so they take security on the easements and the pipelines and whatever else they can describe as to securing the lease, and then they appropriate a lease payment every year to pay the lease, and since it's a lease, it becomes almost an operating expense, and it's not a debt. Then the other one was the special obligation bonds, which the city's issued. I'm not sure for what purposes, but they, pardon?
We did for this.
Yeah, and again, those be supported by net revenues from the stormwater utility.
How much was this building, the bond?
But back in 93, we did get permission to sell bonds with that rate. Now, whether we can still use that permission or not, I don't know, since it's 20 years old. But when we sold the first, did the first utility, we got permission to sell bonds.
Permission from the voters?
Yes.
And what's
is
it?
Any of that authority remaining?
None of it's ever been used.
Ever been issued?
Yeah.
Never been. It's always been a pay-as-you-go utility.
Sounds like a bond council question.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions in the finance billing paying for the utility area? How about operations?
Well, I guess I did have one. Are we okay with the development charge being waived completely if you provide your own detention? Still got water going to the system, which presumably it's the same as what was going to the system before you developed your site, since that's what the city's rules require.
I don't
know. That would be covered by the rate, your monthly rate, but you are adding on to the system.
You know far more about that than I do. I don't.
I'm happy with it.
I knew you would cringe when I said that.
One of my questions for that was, does that extend to residential as well? I don't understand necessarily how that developer side works, commercial versus residential, but if you're developing for residential sites.
Anytime you're doing that, it's going to be a PUD, if I'm correct, right? Which is going to be.
Yeah, I assume if you were in a subdivision that met the new subdivision or the new stormwater regulations, you would be exempt from that stormwater fee for residential house in
for new residential.
For new residential.
Yeah.
Okay, let me pose this idea. What if I, just as a single homeowner, am going to build a new house on a property that hasn't had a house, but I'm going to build it net zero and put in a gray water system so that it recycles all of my stormwater? Would I then be also able to have that fee waived?
I would defer to them. It sounds like no.
We're talking about on that is a development fee that he's talking about. The monthly operating fee cannot be waived. The monthly fee that you pay every month.
You don't. If you're building a house, you're not going
to
pay
a development
fee.
If I'm building a house, I don't have to pay a development fee.
There's a stormwater.
That answers my question. Okay.
A single family, a new house on my own lot that I'm building, I don't pay a development fee.
Right.
Okay. That answers that question.
All right.
I have a question on, we're still on the money side, and I don't know if it's really money or accepting liability, and I think Kim had this comment that we had on our joint sheet, but when we get into annexations, you know, you're taking on a subdivision where the infrastructure was built, and is there an evaluation of that infrastructure before we take on that annex, because we could be taking on additional liability, financial risk, if it's not built to the standards that are current?
It's kind of subject to whatever the annexation agreement is, I guess. When I'm just thinking in particular, I'm working on a project that's been in the progress for a long time on Harvester Road off of Range Line, where a lot of the property is not up to current city code, and part of the development agreement was, or the annexation agreement was, to bring everything up to city code, and it was very expensive for them to do that, and they were kind of in a bad situation since they had their sewer was out of regulation, so they're trying to hook onto the city sewer, but the city was making them, or is part of the annexation, for us to take your property in, you're gonna have to do all this upgrading, and you know, it was way too expensive for them to do that. So the city does look at that. I know that they have in that situation.
So the goal will be to try to bring that system up to current standards as best as possible before annexation although annexations are
It really depends on what we're doing. I'll just use Prairie View up here off of Creasy Springs. There was a lot of houses on that right there that wanted to come into the city. Three or four of them didn't, but we accepted them as is. And so we accepted the streets, we accepted, you know, the sewers, the stormwater, just like it was. Now, if it's something that's went defunct, we used one down at Habitat for Humanity, down there on Old Plank. They wanted to do the same thing. We kind of said, you got to do some different things because it wasn't built out, and they did have to do some street modifications in that area. But if it's completely built out like Prairie View, we normally just accept it the way it is.
Because the overall benefit to the city is perceived to be greater than the problems that you're picking up. Okay, anything else on the money side?
Chris, I brought up the issue with the 40% discount to the University of Missouri.
What about it?
I perceived it to be inequitable for other customers that might qualify for a discount, with the university being the only customer receiving the discount. And when I looked in the ordinances, I didn't find anything to, any criteria justifying a discount. I've since been provided a document tonight.
Let's get an answer to that question. Here's, I'm going to try to phrase the question. Change it if you think I'm wrong. What are the financial and operational realities with regard to the 40% that's being given to the university now? And I'm thinking in terms of what do they do versus what do we do? Why do we do it? And what would happen if we stopped doing it? Is that the question?
And are any other customers potentially eligible for a discount if we keep the discount?
They maintain, Greg's email, I think, summarized it pretty well for me to make me be comfortable with the 40%. And then reading through this, it does line out some specifics of what is the city's and what is the university's they're responsible for, like the public streets within the, I guess if you're a private landowner with property on both sides of the public street, I don't think you would be maintaining the sewers within the public street. Although, I don't know, maybe you could petition the city for a discount and say you would maintain the sewers. I don't know.
My gut is that it's a pretty good deal, but I think the question's a fair one to ask and answer. Okay. In terms of operation of the utility, I can't find too much to question. Anybody else want to, I mean, the amount of money they're getting, the amount of it that's going to actual people that are out there doing it, the rate at which they get the work done. How about other people? Do we?
Kim and I put together a pretty good list here, and I know I didn't get it out till late today, but actually I can circulate around a hard copy. I did email it out to this group, but did not email it to the city staff yet. I will in the morning, but I think there should be enough copies around here, and I'm not going to cover all these items in detail. I don't know if there's
same one.
No, yeah, these are. It's a one pager, right?
I printed out my email, so
on both sides.
Okay. Everybody got one?
Yeah, I've got one.
There's the financial recommendations on one side, but mostly it's operational. I'm not really going to dwell in detail on all this, but I do want to applaud the city. I think the presentation that we saw last week showed that the utility is very well established. They're doing all the right things with the resources they have. There's opportunity for improvement, but there's opportunity for improvement with any entity, and I just threw out a few for consideration. One is to continue and build on the mapping effort you did on GIS and try to do more asset management. Try to get a very good assessment of what you have, because that'll help you set your priorities. I think that one of the things that we draw out as well is there seemed to be not a strong, established criteria for prioritization. I think that one should be drafted that is consistent, draws in staff knowledge, professional knowledge, but also is transparent so that any citizen can review and understand clearly how the utility is prioritizing the work to serve the community's needs. And it could be simple as A, B, and C, 1, 2, 3 are failed, you know, fair or good condition, but whatever the criteria, it needs to be open and public. I think the fact that they are sharing resources between the storm sewer and public utilities is outstanding. I think to continue that effort is applauded. I think as we break down the silos, we talked about silo discussions early on. We want to try to break those down and try to share resources whenever possible to serve the community's needs. One thing that university uses in maintenance is zone assignment. I don't know if you've got ownership areas for your staff, and I don't know if you have enough staff to even do it. But taking ownership in an area or a zone or responsibility, usually personnel take real strong responsibility for that, and we'll do a little bit more job, a little bit better job to meet the need. One thing, I assume that you have contracting services that you draw upon. Encourage you to use that. With limited staff, you really have to use those, and don't try to take on big projects. Really focus on your niche, which is the inspections, the preventative maintenance, the cleaning, and let the contractors take on those bigger construction jobs. The last thing Kim and I dialogued about a little bit is with the organizational change with all the utilities coming under TAD, I think the should be some look at whether the current water and light advisory board stay as is or be expanded to include other utilities. It could go either way. It's just whether it provides value or not, and probably should just be looked at during that evaluation process of merging those utilities. And that's what we provide.
Let me ask you a question about that last one.
Sure.
Are you thinking that the question is whether the Water and Light Board is expanded to deal with the other utilities, or instead of that, a separate similar board to deal with that?
I would think, I don't like multiples. I think that could happen, but that just creates more burden.
No, but is that the question you're asking?
No, I think my question is, should they expand the existing Water and Light Board to encompass the other utilities? Now, you could do two, but I would
okay.
see, for me, one would be easier. And I do think that one of the things that needs to be important with those boards is you have the right people. You've got the right staff that have expertise at utilities, financing, business operation that can provide good, sound advice.
Is your presumption that there should be some citizen advisory board in the area, either expanding Water and Light Board to do it or do another one?
From my perception, it's one of the few areas, storm and sanitary, that does not have a board, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct? And so whether it's a separate board or a combined board.
But you think there should be some citizen advisory system?
Yes, I believe it provides some validation.
Mm-hmm.
For the utilities as they bring information requests and to the council for approval versus just the utility itself. It just provides some third-party validation.
John, you know much more about that than any of the rest of us.
I'd have a couple comments. The first one would be the Water and Light Advisory Board has created a charter. And so if you expand it, then the question becomes the change of charter becomes a voter approval consideration, have to put it on the ballot to change it. That would be a question that need to be answered to, can you change the structure of the Water and Light Advisory Board, since it's created by charter without voter approval, to change the charter to expand those duties. To be the second one, to get at what he was saying in regard to the skill sets that one would have to bring to a advisory board that's greater than the Water and Light Advisory Board, to expand those would be very difficult. There's it's right now it's difficult there are no prerequisites of skill sets or qualifications to be on the Water and Light Advisory Board. That's very simplistic. What you find is that as those that come on the board, that it's probably it take their 4-year terms, and it takes to get to a point of being functional on the board, you're probably going to be in your second term. It's just that the complexity of it is very, you know, the uniqueness of having the Water and Light Department is a combined department, but it's operated as two separate enterprises. To get someone that can speak to water issues is one person, another person to speak to electrical issues, and the enterprise is another person, and to find those that could deal with both of them is somewhat difficult. And so then if you expand it further into stormwater and sewer, then I think you've added to the complexity of the skill sets necessary to be in an advisory capacity.
John?
Yes.
Would it help to have an electric only advisory board and a water, sewer, and stormwater advisory board?
Yeah, I could see the, if you'd stand off the electrical, I think that'd be one thing. Seeing most public works is that most public works has the water component as a part of it. But that could be a possibility, Bill. We don't want to lose mindset that you need to realize that the railroad enterprise is a part of the Water and Light Department, and it has its advisory board, and there, and then the airport has its advisory board. But in summary, another way of trying to describe the situation. I've been on the advisory board for 25 years, and some people think that that's too long, but need to let other people serve. But, you know, and having been a professional engineer and having an academic background and a professional background in public finance, I felt compelled that in order to be the best board member that I could be, I went through the APPA Academy, the American Public Power Association's Academy, and it's 12 courses that you have to endure. And then in order to get certificated in that, you have to pass the national exam. And as a man 67 years old, I'm not, I thought those days were gone. But anyway, you have to pass the national exam. But it's in multiple areas of governance as to the utility business. And sometimes I think that ought to be a requirement for all board members, but you can't require it. But so in summary, I think we'd have to look at a set of qualifications so that you need someone that has the skill sets and knows the utility business and has a finance part of it and so on, or, you know, to balance the board out, you know, you get some, you know, it could be business people, bankers,
combinations with...
Yeah, I've seen boards that actually establish criteria, so they may say, we need two engineers, we need two, you know, financier type, we need two, you know, of these, and you set that criteria, and as they go through, as one person goes off the board, the council then is choosing another engineer, another finance person to go on that board.
Yeah.
So you have the same mix all the time, maybe different individuals, but the same mix.
And the danger is that there'll be some inclination to expand it, and the size of it has worked very well for a very long time. Isn't it interesting that we have an advisory board for the little railroad, we don't have one for sewer and stormwater? I mean, if you think of the size of the, and the important, well, I'm not saying the railroad's not important, but comparatively.
Perhaps Mr. Glasstock would like to comment on advisory boards. You don't have one for solid waste or?
Well, and they're all under CAD now, all the five utilities, and to have, you know, I'll agree with Greg. I think one board would do good service. You got to, you know, it's electrical utility and all the rest are civil functions. And so you have civil engineers. And so as long as you had a mix of people, when I was the interim, we had John, Ernie Gath, Bob Roper, Tom Bumgardner, and I can't remember who the fifth one was, John, but you had financial people. You had engineers, and you had a business person. And
Bill
so
Clough. Bill Clough was
a
long-term.
So and so you got to have a mix of people. You just can't have one.
And not to interrupt you, I always thought it was interesting that Richard Wallace was a member of the Water and Light Advisory Board at one time and went on to become the chancellor. But very few people know that Richard Wallace has a degree in electrical engineering. And the guy was right on spot.
Dave Wallersheim was on there for a while.
Oh, yeah, and Dave Wallersheim.
Pugh was, too, wasn't he?
Pardon?
Pugh was for a
while. Yeah, because I took Bob Pugh's place in 1990.
So.
But
I think as long as you don't mix up the same, I mean, you want some diversity in there. You don't want all civil engineers. You don't want all electrical engineers. You kind of want a diversity because it brings creativity. And you also need the finance people, the business people to bring in the
John,
perspective of the business.
For 25 years, we've had stability, and that's a good thing.
And you know, like Dave Wallersheim, he was, you know, a professor of mechanical engineering and dealt with a specialty in power supply, and so he was really a...
So now that we have them all under one person, I think it's time to consider.
Is there a street advisory board?
No.
Or solid waste?
No. There's not.
What do other
There's
cities do?
One for
do?
The airport.
What do other cities do, I wonder?
Yeah, we'd have to look, but, you know, I think other cities, they do it each way. I mean, they have to.
I've seen.
Not a lot of people have electrical utility, I'll just say.
Right. I've seen a lot of the titled utility boards, mm-hmm. utilities mm-hmm. board, or the Board of Public Utilities.
I'm
or
sure
board
Springfield has a board of some kind.
Board of Public Utilities. So.
It's a complicated topic, and I think that you don't want to, you really need a separate entity that's kind of reviewing, advising, and then when you do go to council's got some comfort that it was someone else has looked at it and they agree that the utility needs to do this. I think the last thing you'd want is the board second guessing every decision you guys make because they're not as experienced in the utility industry and the long-term needs of the utility and how they finance and build.
Enough.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Thoughts on this? I hear people generally believing that some citizen advisory entity is something we should look at seriously. And the interesting question is whether it should be a responsibility of the current Water and Light Board, or there should be some new entity. That I don't want to put words in anybody's mouth. I'm just trying to.
Electric's a big responsibility. I think it can stand alone.
That's another possible way to do it.
I think I had that feeling too, or maybe it was talked about it at council when the mayor was discussing putting this together about maybe in the future there would be a storm and sanitary.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of why it seemed to make sense to me at the time.
And well, then the question becomes, where should water be? Yeah. You know,
water and electricity don't mix.
Good point.
Ted, okay. How often does that board meet?
Oh, we meet once a month.
Once a month?
Once a month, and probably in a year's time, we probably meet 15 times.
Monthly. It's monthly meetings. I just want to make sure you understand that, as John Conway had mentioned, the Water and Light Advisory Board is a chartered board, and if you're considering trying to make a recommendation to split it out, that would certainly require a vote to be able to change that mix. I mean, just like my position, the utility director position also serves as the Water and Light Director. So to the extent that could be accommodated with a board reshuffle, we'd have to consult legal with that. I don't really know, but it might be worth an investigation of.
I have to say that I think there's value to this, particularly with the mayor's call to break down silos. I can see, I mean, I'm not a professional in this field, clearly, but it would break down silos, I would think, if you had everybody together as opposed to separating them out. I understand that it would be more difficult and all that, but it seems like it would be worth it.
And just a cautionary note, we're not rising to any conclusions here yet. We're just kind of asking each other questions and playing with possible answers. I don't want anybody to portray or perceive us as having reached conclusions about any of this stuff. Pay attention back there? Okay. Okay. Anything else?
Did anybody think my suggestion on rain gauges were important?
No.
I think it would be a useful tool, but I don't know how, like maybe for me, I don't know how much of a service it would provide for the cost.
And I think it goes beyond reaching down into the operational job of making, of doing the job, of telling them what tools they should buy. Hammers versus, you know, and I kind of agree with you, but I think we let them come to that conclusion.
Well, see, are we going to get through that, though? I'm kind of a data guy, and the more data you can get, the better informed you get. I guess this, would that work there, David and Aaron, as to what would we do with that data?
Evaluate.
I pretty much got the most rain.
I learned something yesterday from our GIS specialist, and the ESRI Corporation that pretty much drives the GIS system in the world is now merging with many of the modeling companies, and it's very close. We actually have a beta trial that we haven't played with it yet, but it's actually going to allow a GIS topographic map and as well as the piping infrastructure. You could simulate whatever rainfall event you want to have, and it's going to tell you where your water is going to flow through modeling. That's going to provide much more valuable information than rain gauges or measuring flow at different, you know, troughs and everything else like that. So as that technology develops, I would highly recommend the city looking at investing that modeling tool. The university is looking at it because I think it's going to be very valuable information, very valuable tool to plan constraints and issues, especially with developments. If you get development coming in and you're going to add it, you can get it planned out, you can look how is that going to impact the system. So I think there's lots of opportunity with technology going forward.
It is one valuable piece of data.
And they do.
I'd like for you to make that as a motion for the MS4 to look at, because we're all together, the county, the city, and the university, on an MS4 permit for stormwater. So I would like for you to.
I'll put that in my list of recommendations.
But we, Greg, we currently do that in the water and electric. Those are
modeling. We do as well for water, steam, chill water, and electric. But we don't do it for storm. But we're looking into it.
Okay, let's think about next time.
far as operational, I guess, just real quick, just very quick and very minor. But I know for sanitary sewer, whenever somebody pulls a demo permit, they do a connection report on the private tap onto the main. I mean, as far as stormwater, I know it's not as big a deal as far as inflow and infiltration. I mean, you want the water to go in the storm pipes. But just seeing where the private storm lines connect to the public system and verifying how those pipes, like as far as what kind of shape they're in. And then as far as, I know on the sewer report, Bill could probably tell you more, but they say what has to be done for in the future.
Thank you, because I have forgotten that I had wanted to ask about that. Infiltration and exfiltration. Water getting in there from the sewer system and water getting into the sewer from the stormwater. What kind of data do you have about that? You know what do you? I guess my question is, what do you know about it?
Got another 2 hours. Got another 2 hours.
Yeah.
How many hours do we want to talk? Really, we've kind of thought with our first presentation that we were going to push that entire issue off to the sanitary sewer because it is really a problem more with the sanitary system than it is with the storm drainage system.
Okay, that makes sense.
I mean, I don't want to.
Well, we got to pick it. We got to do it in one or the other. If you guys think it makes more sense to do
really
it there.
It really does, in my opinion, make
Let's
more
do it
sense
there.
Because it impacts the sanitary sewer in a more negative impact to that and the wastewater plant.
All right.
Homeowners.
That's cool.
Okay.
So next time, we're going to hear the next report. Are you guys scheduled to give the next report next time? But do you also want to make, between now and then, we'll get more information from you about the questions we asked about this. Do we want to also spend some time trying to put together draft recommendations on stormwater next time?
Draft.
So those...
Big draft.
Very much draft.
I think we want to take the consensus that we have, put it in one document. If I don't know who would do that, but hold that until the end.
Yeah.
And
so
careful about overlapping because as we had a barrage of information with this. I'd like to absorb that and then move to the next before we overlap.
Then I hear two big agenda items for next time. One is the next report that we'll get. And second, we'll be working on some draft recommendations on stormwater. Everybody think that's where we are?
Is it, and I'm trying to tack on to staff here, is it possible if we give all our recommendations to Carol, she can merge those in a succinct document that we can then start drafting or editing from there? Is that possible? And, you know, we could flag or remove duplication. But
exactly.
Chris, I've got a list of 8 questions I sent in last time that I haven't got answers to yet.
Which ones don't you have answers to? Oh, you got the list. Well, okay. You guys take a look at the list and see what you can do. All right. You emailed this to them.
Yes.
All right. Let's see if we can get answers.
Carol's got the list, right?
Correct.
I'll give you a copy of it right when we're done here, too.
She's working through getting the answers.
Thank you.
Anything else from anybody? Well, then we can go home and see our families, because you've got to be back here first thing in the morning, I think. Cool. Thank you all very much. We'll be adjourned.